everybody, and thank you for dialing into this interim results telephone call. If you go to the presentation to page number three, that's where we'll start. I will try and keep this call relatively short, maybe 20-25 minutes, and then allow us to have Q&A after that. So on page three, you can see the first half results. You can see net profit of about $500,000 US during the first half. This came despite an investment of about $36 million in our innovation activities during that period. The commercial platform did very well in the first half, with net profit up about 12% to $22.1 million after tax, mainly driven by the prescription drug business. So, you know, again, it's a story of continued progress on the pipeline of innovative drug candidates that we have, and that being funded by the commercial platform and you know, the profitable mature business that we've built over the last 15 years. Moving on to page four, it talks about the cash position. Currently, the cash available to the group, or to TriMet Group, is around $197 million US. About 122 of that is cash and cash equivalents and very short-term investments. We have, in addition to that, another $75 million in unutilized banking facilities. So, you know, we find ourselves in a fairly strong position from a cash standpoint. The bottom of page four shows the JV cash position, where we hold about $72 million in cash in our joint ventures, mainly the Shanghai prescription drug joint venture and the Guangzhou OTC joint venture. We expect also to receive some pretty big compensation from the Shanghai government for our land in the fourth quarter of this year, September, October, actually. That should deliver us a net gain of about $35 to $37 million this year, and a dividend of around $40 million to the TriMet Group next year. So cash-wise, we're in a strong cash position. Page five shows the guidance for the year. This is the first time we've issued guidance as a company. In order to sort of improve transparency and to give everybody an understanding of where we are, we decided to do it. If you look at the guidance, you can see that the highlighted areas, the three circled numbers. Number one is the investment in innovation activities this year is about $80 to $85 million US. So you'll be able to calculate the net loss for the innovation platform by simply subtracting the operating expenses from the revenues. That will be offset in the full year by a big amount of profit or net income that's coming from our commercial platform. You can see $63 to $66 million in net income estimated for 2016. That's core business of about $28-$29 million after tax. And then a one-time property gain from the Shanghai land that I mentioned earlier, about $35 to $37 million. Then you've got the costs, the general costs of admin and interest and tax, about $16 to $18 million, and net profit of $0 to $5 million for the year. So, you know, big investment in innovation that actually is well ahead of what we spent last year. And if you look at the 3 years in a row, 14, 15, and 16, you can see that the total investment in our pipeline adds up to pretty much $200 million US, which is, you know, it's a big acceleration of where we've been in the past. I think in the last 15 years total, it's about $400 million. So you can see we're growing very rapidly as far as our investment in our pipeline as those assets reach the late stage. On to page seven, you can see strategically what we're all about. It's about a risk-balanced approach. We have really tried not to be a binary biotech company. It's about a diversified pipeline and multiple shots on goal. So, you know, we seek on the left-hand side of the chart to focus on targets, kinase targets that have high potential, sort of home run opportunities. CMET, SYK, FGFR, These are all targets that have a very deep body of evidence around them, but they've had a lot of problems. You've had a lot of big pharma, big biotech companies that over time have failed for one reason or another. And what we try to do is we try to learn from those issues. We try to be the fastest to solve those issues and to put ourselves into sort of first in class position by being very, very rapid to deal with the problems that that these first companies or these first movers have faced. The second area is less risky. That is focusing on validated targets like VGFR, EGFR, PI3K delta. These are targets where there are approved drugs out there globally. But generally, first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the 28 or so that have been approved over the last 15, 16, 17 years, generally they're multi-kinase inhibitors that hit many targets, have a lot of off-target toxicities, tolerability issues. And we've always felt, Dr. Weiguo Su, our chief scientific officer, has always felt there's a lot of opportunity to optimize these first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So that's what we've focused on doing. So those are the two kind of main areas of targets that we go after. Now, we leverage the last box, our strength, to do that efficiently and effectively. You know, we have a big operation in China, generally lower cost, big patient populations in China in the field of oncology that we're able to trial our drug candidates on through proof of concept, where we de-risk them and then we go global. You can see the team is 310 scientists and staff. It's a big organization that is necessary to manage 7 clinical drug candidates in 25 different clinical studies around the world. And then finally, you know, from a financing standpoint, we've been very practical. We have accessed equity capital markets at various times on AIM and now NASDAQ, but we also have worked hard to fund our operations through partnerships at various stages through the years with Big Pharma. So that gives us a very diverse, deep clinical pipeline, multiple shots. You know, we have 7 pivotal studies that 4 of them are enrolling at the moment. Another 3 we expect to start in the next 6 to 8 months. We're not a binary proposition, and we're underpinned by a solid financial situation thanks to our commercial platform, Profit, and our partners. So moving on to page 9, very briefly, as I mentioned, large team, high focus on chemistry. I won't go into any more detail on page 9. Page 10 and 11, these are two slides that are worth having a look at. On page 10, we talk about our programs are chemistry-driven, seriously selective small molecules. So you can see on the top right, savolitinib and fruquintinib, you know, very selective inhibitors of c-MET, savolitinib, and VGFR for fruquintinib. On savolitinib in particular, you've got a 1,000-fold difference as far as selectivity is concerned between c-MET and the next kinase it hits, which is PAC3. And on fruquintinib, the difference is about 250-fold. So it's about designing small molecule compounds, all of them designed internally, focusing on the use of co-crystal structures, really elucidating the protein or the kinase we're going after and designing small molecule compounds that really do just bind to it and not other kinases in the kinase domain. So highly selective compounds, which makes them very clean, better target coverage, less toxicity. Now, page 11 lays out, it's a very detailed chart, but it gives a sense of the whole first generation of small molecule targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors. There are 28 approved. And you can see the bar charts on the left-hand side of the page. You know, for the compounds that have reported dose interruptions and dose reduction data, you can see that about half of those, of those compounds, about half of the patients require dose interruptions or dose reductions. That basically means that the patients are not tolerating these drugs. I mean, they provide great benefit. They're first generation. They do a good job hitting their targets, but they do hit a lot of other off-target kinases and cause a lot of tolerability issues. So the chart on the right, you can see for Sutent, for example, sunitinib, It's a very effective VEGFR inhibitor, but it hits many other kinases as well. And while it does over $1 billion in sales, you can see dose interruptions and dose reductions over 50% for Sutent. So patients are having a hard time tolerating this particular drug. If you look at our compounds, savolitinib, fruquintinib, sulfatinib, and apitinib down at the bottom of that chart, you can see dose reductions, most of them in the sort of single digit or low teens. And, you know, fruquintinib in colorectal cancer, you see 28% dose reductions, a bit higher, but that's because that patient population is a very sick patient population. They are third line and above. So these are patients that have failed two lines of chemotherapy or more and are still progressing. So with a median overall survival of around 5 months. So that's the idea, is using chemistry as our advantage to design highly selective small molecule drugs that are more tolerable, that better cover the target, that are oral doses and allow patients to tolerate them for longer so you can treat the disease more uniformly over longer periods of time. Weiguo and his team have designed all seven of our drug candidates along those lines, and we have no multi-kinase inhibitors in our portfolio. Page 12 shows the pipeline. I think the highlight on this pipeline, you know, 25 different clinical studies all enrolling at the moment. The ones highlighted in red are the either the pivotal studies that are currently enrolling or the ones that are set to initiate before the middle of 2017. So we target to have seven pivotal studies enrolling by the first half of 2017, and that's a big portfolio of late stage programs. So moving on to savolitinib, page 14, very briefly. This is a chart that many people on this call have already seen and heard before, but box number four is worth having a touching on. This is the deal we just did with AstraZeneca to amend our existing collaboration agreement, where we are now stepping forward and over the next 3 years putting about $50 million into the joint development costs on savolitinib in return for an increase in our royalty by 5 percentage points. You know, the concept here is that we are stepping forward to help out in the very large development costs and plan on savolitinib. As we've gone through the last 4 years and have identified through exploratory development in many areas of lung cancer, gastric cancer, colorectal cancer, renal cell carcinoma, we now know where we want to go in the late stage. It's a very big program. And, you know, our stepping forward and putting some money in and increasing our economic interest in savolitinib makes a lot of sense for us at this moment. But we must remember that this $50 million still is just a fraction of the total cost of these development programs. AstraZeneca remains the by far the larger funder of this clinical activity. So savolitinib in papillary renal cell carcinoma, page 15. I won't go into details because we've seen that chart before, but 16 and 17 are worth having a quick look at. Page 16, you can see papillary renal cell carcinoma represents about 15 to 20% of renal cell carcinoma. It's about 50,000 new patients a year globally. Today, there are no recommended treatments for these patients. The existing renal cell carcinoma treatments, Sutent and pazopanib, are not particularly, you know, only modest efficacy in these PRCC patients. So, you know, there's a big unmet medical need to design drug candidates that benefit this patient population. And CMET is a major driver of papillary renal cell carcinoma. So this is why we focused in this area. Page 17, you can see all of the renal cell carcinoma studies we have ongoing at the moment. The papillary renal cell carcinoma study, the phase two, we've completed enrollment. We'll publish the results of this probably very early in 2017. It's a study that's been run by Dr. Tony Choueiri of Dana-Farber in Boston, who is essentially the leading light in kidney cancer and behind most of the innovations that have been approved in kidney cancer globally in the last few years. So Dr. Chueri will publish those results in a conference early in the new year. The PAPMET study, you can see there, is a metastatic papillary renal cell carcinoma study comparing Sutent, cabozantinib, crizotinib, and savolitinib. This is a study sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. So, you know, this is, and it's a very important study because it really compares a selective c-MET inhibitor against multi-kinase c-MET inhibitors, crizotinib and cabozantinib, which have, as you can see for cabozantinib in the chart on tolerability earlier, you've got 70% of patients that have to go on to dose reductions on cabozantinib. So, you know, I think we will, savolitinib will do well in this study, and it's good that we're doing it. Calypso study, the last three lines of that chart are being conducted at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. It's combinations with durvalumab, the PD-L1 antibody, immuno-oncology agent, savolitinib in clear cell renal cell carcinoma as well as papillary. So very exciting study. Page 18 just lays out the multiple c-MET aberrant patient populations in the treatment, in the non-small cell lung cancer treatment algorithm. So you see in the first line setting, about 6% of patients are going to be sensitive to a selective c-MET inhibitor. Either they have exon 14 skipping or they have c-MET gene amplification. So that's the patient population we're going after. Now, the second line setting for EGFR mutant patients who build resistance to Iressa and Tarceva, you see 16% MET aberrants there. It's sort of 15 to 20% of patients. The resistance to Iressa and Tarceva is because of MET gene amplification. So we're studying that patient population closely in combination with Tagrisso, which is a drug that's just recently been approved last December for those T790M patients. In AstraZeneca is the owner of Tagrisso, and it was also the fastest or one of the fastest FDA approvals in history, from first in man to approval in 2 years, 8 months. But when people build resistance to Tagrisso, which is emerging now, it shows that about 20%, 18 to 20% of those patients, it's because of c-MET. So what you see in this chart on page 18 is that c-MET is a driver of cancer cell proliferation in multiple lines of treatments in this non-small cell lung cancer algorithm. So we expect a lot of opportunity here. And this is one of the reasons we did the deal with AstraZeneca to put in $50 million, is because in lung cancer, we're now studying five different treatment areas in lung cancer, and I'll explain those later. So page 19 is in the first line setting. You can see crizotinib, the waterfall plot there. It shows crizotinib data that was published in exon 14 skipping patients. Looks very good, but the problem is durability of response. So when you've got a multi-kinase inhibitor, it covers MET, but it doesn't cover it fully, leaving the door open for those cancer cells to continue to proliferate. Looking at chart number four there, you can see that savolitinib just shuts down MET 24 hours a day, 100%, doesn't leave the door open at all. So you can see the little red line of crizotinib trending upwards. That means that the door is left open and those cancer cells start to proliferate, whereas the purple line for savolitinib is flat at zero, basically. Those cancer cells can't proliferate when they're shut off. Moving on to page 20 and 21, you can see the second-line non-small cell lung cancer patients. You know, we've seen some outstanding efficacy in these patients. AstraZeneca paid us $10 million U.S. dollars a milestone in June of this year as we started a phase 2B study in second-line non-small cell lung cancer. That study should complete enrollment by the end of this year, at which point we'll make a decision on the global phase 3. If we are able to see the same levels of efficacy we've seen to date, we are optimistic that we will proceed into a global phase 3 study or global pivotal study. Page 22 is the third line setting to Tagrisso-resistant patients, 18% here. That chart in the top right-hand side was a chart that was published by Clovis at ASCO this year that showed 26% of resistant patients to T790M inhibitors were c-MET driven. So you've got a patient population of sort of 18, maybe into the 20% range, which is a big opportunity for savolitinib. So page 23 shows all of the five different areas that savolitinib is being tested in the phase two setting for treatment in these non-small cell lung cancer patients. So very aggressive clinical program that we have underway for savolitinib in lung cancer. Moving on to page 25, I won't go through all of the lung cancer studies on 24. Page 25, you can see gastric cancer. It's a big problem in Asia. Roughly half of the world's gastric cancer patients are in China, South Korea, Japan, about 500,000 patients a year. You can see on the charts in box number two there, gastric cancer just has not made much progress over the last few years, whereas colorectal cancer, for example, you can see the median median overall survival has improved from maybe 12 months up to almost 30 months in the last few years, whereas gastric's been very flat. So that brings us to the VICTORY trial, which is in box number three. This is a study that's being conducted by Samsung Medical Center in South Korea, one of the largest molecular analysis-driven gastric cancer studies that's ever been conducted. 309 patients, all of whom have their molecular status or the drivers of cell proliferation analyzed and understood. You can see that c-MET, MET amplification, is about 6% of patients. We've always said it's around 10%. So it's there in the sort of 6 to 10% range. So patients with MET amplification will be put onto savolitinib. Patients with other mutations and genetic drivers will be put onto other treatments. But the next page on page 26 shows you a 34-year-old male patient with c-MET-driven gastric cancer. And you can see just a startling visual of the before and after treatment of savolitinib. So on the before, you see a lot of black areas. These are tumors in the whole gastrointestinal tract and stomach and the esophagus at the top of there, closer to the neck. And you can see that after 3 weeks on savolitinib, you completely shut off the cancer cell proliferation activity. So, you know, this is a powerful selective c-MET inhibitor in a powerfully MET-driven type of solid tumor. Terrific results, basically. So page 27 shows our gastric cancer activities. A lot of it is driven by the VICTORY study in South Korea, but also a fair amount of activity in China where we are running those clinical studies. So moving on to page 29 for fruquintinib, highly selective VEGFR inhibitor, as we've said, completed enrollment in our first phase three pivotal study in third line colorectal cancer. That study will read out very early 2017. The phase three in non-small cell lung cancer is well underway. We expect to complete enrollment of that phase three in lung cancer by probably early next year. So pretty exciting where we are on fruquintinib. On page 30, you can see the phase two data in colorectal cancer, where the charts on the right-hand side of the page show progression-free survival and overall survival benefits of fruquintinib relative to the best standard of care, and they're highly statistically significant benefits. So, you know, that's what drove us to the phase three, and now the phase three is going to read out very early next year. So we're very excited about fruquintinib and are working very well with Eli Lilly to move that program. Also on fruquintinib, we've built a formulation facility in Suzhou that can commercialize or produce commercial supplies of fruquintinib for its launch. So that's all up and ready to go for when and if we get approved based on this phase three result. So sulfatinib on page 31, two phase three studies enrolling, one in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, one in non-pancreatic NET. We've seen fantastic efficacy in our clinical studies so far. In the phase 1A, we saw 40-odd percent response and an 18-month median progression-free survival. That compares to Sutent and Afinitor in pancreatic NET with median progression-free survival in the 11-month range. So it's a big improvement, but it is a small patient population, that phase 1A, only about 20-odd patients. So we enrolled an 81-patient phase 2 study. That's ongoing, fully enrolled, but a progression-free survival, median progression-free survival is not yet reached. We expect that to be reached in the second half of this year, and we'll publish that data early 2017. So we're quite positive about sulfatinib in these NET patients. We also have a phase 2 study in thyroid cancer and a phase 2 study in biliary tract carcinoma that's about to kick off. So moving to upitanib on page 34, you can see continued high levels of efficacy in brain metastasis patients. So today, the first-line treatments for EGFR mutant positive non-small cell lung cancer are Iressa and Tarceva. They work well in the lung, but they tend to not reach high levels of drug exposure in the brain because they can't pass the blood-brain barrier. Weiguo and the team designed upitanib to pass through the blood-brain barrier. And so you can see here in these four or so patients that we show the CT scans of the brain, you can see the lesions in the brain, the brain metastases shrinking with exposure to upitanib. So we're very excited about upitanib, and we intend to start a pivotal study on upitanib around the end of the year. Page 36 just details the seven key sort of shots at pivotal success that we have over the next sort of 9 months. Savolitinib, the papillary renal cell carcinoma, second-line lung cancer. Fruquintinib is colorectal and lung. Sulfatinib is the two pancreatic and extra-pancreatic NET phase threes, and then upitanib in pivotal study in brain mets, non-small cell lung cancer. So everything's playing out, and you know, we're very focused on execution and moving this program through. I won't go through all the other drug candidates because they are there is less to talk about, but they're all progressing. 523, our selective TYK inhibitor, progressing well with regards to rheumatoid arthritis. We're hoping to start our phase 2 study globally next year. And in hematological malignancies, 523 is really approaching a period of time in the next 6 to 9 months where we expect to see some proof of concept playing out and some efficacy among these patients. 689, our highly potent PI3K delta compound is progressing now in phase 1 in Australia, and we expect to be in lymphoma patients probably early next year. Filgotinib and the reformulated 004 are progressing as well. So we won't go into a lot of detail, but we've published a very detailed results announcement which goes into a lot more detail on each of these clinical programs and each of these drug candidates. Briefly on the commercial platform, on page 45, we're up to now over 2,000 medical reps across China. Very strong organization detailing our own manufactured drugs as well as certain third-party drugs. We've built a central nervous system medical detailing team now of 132 reps over the last year that are detailing Seroquel and doing very well. Moving on to 46 and 47, you can see the chart that shows the 13 or so year history of our commercial platform growing from 20 million in sales in 2003 to, you know, really 30 times that level in this first half. Profitability, tremendous. The first half net profit after tax of 47.9 million US, our share of which was 22.1 million, up 12% versus last year. We lost about 6% because of foreign exchange reporting in US dollars here. So, you know, the numbers would have been better if we'd had a stable currency during that time. The sales would have been over 20% and the net profit would have been sort of high teens. That said, we've fared fairly well through the last 10 years as the RMB has strengthened. So, you know, you get good and bad in this case. And this last quarter, this last half, we were hurt a little bit, but still the business went very well and performed well. Page 47, just shows a chart that lays out, while we have over 200 products that our joint ventures and our various subsidiaries in China market, really there are seven key products in our portfolio that make up over 90% of the gross profit of our business. The biggest being Shoshan Baoshan pill, the coronary artery disease cardiovascular prescription drug that has done so well in recent years. So gives you a bit more information in that area. And I'll leave it on page 49 finally, just with the upcoming near-term catalysts. We'll be publishing data on four drugs in the next, call it 8 months, on five different clinical studies with an aggregate of about 750 patients, give or take, in those studies. Savolitinib phase 2 data that I talked about, epitinib phase 1b data in brain mets patients, about 30 brain mets patients, which we've talked about. The fruquintinib phase 2 data in third line non-small cell lung cancer, we'll publish that in detail, but actually Eli Lilly has already paid us a $10 million milestone because that phase 2 data met its primary endpoints. Sulfatinib, the phase 2 data in pancreatic and extrapancreatic NET, we'll publish that data when we hit the median progression-free survival, probably very early next year. Well, we'll meet the PFS, median PFS this year, probably late in the year, and we'll publish it early next year. And then finally, the big one is the phase 3 top-line data in colorectal cancer that will hopefully, if positive, precede an NDA submission a few months later by mid-2017. So these are the data that we'll publish. In addition, during that period, we'll initiate these three further pivotal studies. The savolitinib phase 3 in papillary renal cell carcinoma that we mentioned yesterday in our release with AstraZeneca. The phase 3 or 2 pivotal study on epitinib, depending on the phase 1b, strength of the phase 1b data, it might be a pivotal phase 2, or it could be a double-blind, placebo-controlled pivotal phase 3. That's still to be determined over the next few months. And then finally, the combination with Tagrisso, hopefully the phase 2b data that reads out around the end of this year will drive a phase 3 decision in that combination study in that very important patient population. So that's where we are. I'll leave it there, and I'll open it up for questions now. Is the moderator there? Sonia?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Yeah, we'll open it up for questions now.
Okay, thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Make sure that your line is unmuted locally, and you will be advised when to ask your question. We've got a couple of questions. The first one is from Ying. So, Ying, please go ahead with your question now.
Oh, thank you for taking my question. Good morning, I guess good afternoon for you guys in London. A few from me first. Can you confirm that the amendment with AstraZeneca in the collaboration part agreement, so you will pitch in $50 million. Is that specifically only for PRCC development? And then for the higher royalty, is that across all indications? So that's beyond PRCC. That includes non-small cell lung cancer, I guess. And then second question is, what's the feedback from the FDA in your end of phase 2 meeting on savolitinib in PRCC indication? And have you disclosed what kind of endpoint you'd use for the phase 3 trial? And lastly, on the SYK inhibitor, it sounds like FDA wants more information. Can you maybe provide a little bit more color on that one? Thank you.
Okay, Ying, thanks for your questions. So on the first question, on the $50 million pitching it in, is it only for PRCC? Yes, the $50 million will be used primarily for PRCC. Now, that is not the entire cost of the PRCC program. Actually, AstraZeneca will be putting in probably about the same again on PRCC. Now, you have to remember, the PRCC study, it's not just the clinical cost, but you've got the companion diagnostic, which is initially being trailblazed for PRCC, but it'll most likely be used in pretty much the same form for non-small cell lung cancer and an all c-met-driven disease. So companion diagnostic costs are included in ASTRA and in the 50 plus the additional, call it 50, that are being spent on that. Also, we've got the establishment of manufacturing commercial supply. So we are working on that as well. So CMC is a major area of investment that AstraZeneca is putting the money in. So this is by no means Chimed taking the entire cost of the PRCC program. Yes, maybe from a clinical standpoint, it's a higher proportion of it, but this is also precipitating many other lines of investment, CMC, all the sort of the diagnostic costs, et cetera. With regards to the royalty, the additional 5% is across all indications. So lung cancer, gastric, any indication that savolitinib is approved in, that 5% royalty will be on all sales, basically. The second question on the end of phase two meeting with the FDA, we can't go into huge amounts of details here. We've had end of phase two meetings with the FDA as well as EMA. They were very positive interactions. We clearly laid out, preliminary type information on the phase twos. MET-driven papillary renal cell carcinoma is clearly an unmet medical need, and there's no disagreement with that. With regards to the final design of the phase three, pivotal phase three study, that's an ongoing discussion with both regulatory bodies. While there are no approved therapies in papillary renal cell carcinoma directly for papillary renal cell carcinoma and definitely not for MET-driven papillary renal cell carcinoma, you do have approvals on a broad umbrella renal cell carcinoma indication that, Sutent, for example, is often used in PRCC, while the efficacy of a Sutent is only modest in non-clear cell. There is that complexity that needs to be designed into the pivotal phase three study. So I'd say the end of phase two was all good, but we continue to discuss and work through the details on the pivotal study. Now, the good thing is we're waiting for the companion diagnostic to be ready by the end of this year. So we're working right now on the phase three protocol and it all plays out to hopefully being able to start this study around the end of the year, and that's what we've indicated in our materials. On the SYK inhibitor, there's really no bad news to report. We've completed the phase one. What we found in the phase one is, we went to submit our US IND to the FDA, submitted it, had back and forth with the FDA. There is a human metabolite that played out in the phase one that is evident in a far greater portion of humans than in animal models in preclinical. So that's a metabolite that we do not feel is a problem metabolite, but it certainly is in humans. It's evident at a level that requires some tox testing and to ensure that we know this metabolite's not a problem area. And so that's the work we're doing at the moment. We'll submit that to the FDA in due course. But I think what that means is as we work on this, as well as some drug-drug interaction studies, we'll probably be ready to start the global phase two on HMPL-523 in 2017, probably the second half, hopefully. And we remain positive on that. I think the good news on 523 is also that we got clearance from the Chinese authorities to go all the way through phase three without going back with any formal submissions on the SYK inhibitor. So we're about to kick off our hematological malignancy dose escalation study in China, and we can expect to go pretty rapidly with that. In addition to the Australian hematological malignancy study we're doing at the moment, as well as submitting our US IND in in the lymphoma leukemia area. So 523 moving rapidly, and I think we're all in reasonably good shape.
Thanks very much, Christian. If I may just have two more quick follow-ups. One is that for the PRCC indication for phase two to the planned phase three, are you using the same companion diagnostic developed by Foundation Medicine? And also, what shall we expect at ESMO from savolitinib in October?
Okay, so in the phase two was an open label study that didn't pre-screen patients, but what we did is PRCC patients were enrolled, and then we did full molecular analysis of those patients to determine what were the key genetic drivers of the disease. You know, there are many different areas of MET adherence that cause these patients' tumor cells to proliferate. So the phase two was about really identifying what are the particular MET mutations or gene amplification levels that we needed to identify in pre-screening for the phase three to really identify well the patients that will respond well. So the phase three is the companion diagnostic that all patients will be screened prior to treatment with savolitinib. And we're working with Foundation Medicine now and AstraZeneca to put together the companion diagnostic. As I said, all of molecular drivers that we need to identify have been identified, and we're designing our diagnostic to effectively select those patients. That'll be ready by the end of the year and be ready for the phase three to kick off at that point. Sorry, the second question?
What shall we expect at the European Society of Medical Oncology meeting?
So ESMO, we submitted an abstract to ESMO, but we've pulled it. And the reason we pulled it is because Tony Chueri, our lead investigator, who's really been behind all the major innovations in this field over the last few years, felt that we needed to have a relatively high-profile presentation of this PRCC data because it is so unique and it is on such a large scale. This is the biggest PRCC phase two that's ever been done. So instead of being what would be a relatively small part of ESMO, we're intending to publish the phase two data in full at ASCO GU, which is in February, in Orlando.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Our next question comes from the line of John Newman. So, John, please go ahead with your question now, please.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. Christian, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about other areas where AstraZeneca, you think, might be open to either additional studies with savolitinib or any of the other assets. And also, on the SYK inhibitor, can you also just remind us how that compound is differentiated from some of the other SYKs that have been tried, specifically in rheumatoid arthritis? Thanks.
Okay, great. So other studies and AstraZeneca's view towards other studies. I mean, we published in the announcement we made yesterday around the amendment to the AstraZeneca deal. In the second paragraph of that announcement, there's a link, and it links you to a table, a full update table on all the clinical studies that we've got going on. We've got a lot of exploratory studies going on at the moment in kidney, both clear cell as well as papillary, monotherapies as well as combinations with the PD-L1, durvalumab, PD-L1 antibody. So that's kidney and lung. Obviously, we hit all of these MET-driven patient populations, five or so of those patient populations. And then gastric, the VICTORY study that we're doing with Samsung Medical Center in Korea is a tremendous study. So you can see we're doing an awful lot of exploratory studies, including a fair amount of investigator-led studies, and as well as funded studies by Astra and funded studies by us. There are more. I mean, MET is a driver cell proliferation in many different solid tumor types. We've seen, for example, in colorectal cancer, high levels of response in MET-driven colorectal cancer patients. And we expect, as we sort of knock off these really important major indications, talking lung and kidney, that as we you know, reach approvals in these areas in due course, if and when we reach approvals, we'll then go on to any number of other indications. I think the idea of savolitinib in combinations with other targeted therapies or immuno-oncology agents is very exciting as well, because it's so selective and it's so clean. You know, we feel that it'll be high potential to be used in combination in many situations. So other studies, Astra is a very exploratory driven, science driven company. And, you know, we look for areas where patients respond, and then we just increase the investment in it, as we have in our current programs. On the SYK inhibitor, how is it differentiated? Well, it's been differentiated primarily around its selectivity. So you can see in our charts, there's a chart that shows HMPL-523 selectivity relative to fostamatinib, the Rigel Astra SYK inhibitor. It's on page 38 of the charts. You can see on box number 2 there, it basically 523 is highly selective to SYK. It took Weiguo and his team, you know, 6 or so years to get 523 into the clinic, because we were so discriminating on the selectivity and you know, fostamatinib, the main issue was toxicity, hypertension and gastrointestinal tox because of off-target kinase inhibition. And we don't have that problem. Our phase 1, we've seen no gastrointestinal tox and no hypertension whatsoever. So that's the main point of differentiation, John, is selectivity. I think the other area is tissue distribution, you know, the pharmacokinetic profile of 523. Its tissue distribution is vastly more evident than distribution on a whole blood level. So it is designed to get into the tissue. And with regards to immunology, rheumatoid arthritis, and actually also slightly counterintuitively for hematological malignancies, it's about getting the drug exposure in the lymph and in the tissue to a high enough level to shut down B cell activation. And so that, I think, is going to be a point of differentiation for 523 that's going to play out over the coming years, is its very high levels of tissue distribution relative to the whole blood level.
Great, thank you.
Pleasure.
Our next question comes from the line of Tom. So, Tom, please go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I had a kind of a global question. Is it a coincidence that you essentially broke even? Is that a line you feel you have to walk for a while, or do you think you can spend whatever you need to? Just your thoughts there.
Good question, Tom. You know, It's a line that we've felt that we had to walk over the last 5, 6, 7 years. We've worked really hard to do it. I think this pragmatic approach to financing has got us to where we are today, with a highly diversified portfolio of relatively late stage assets with multiple shots on goal. You know, we never wanted to be a binary biotech, so we never wanted spending to get ahead of itself that put a lot of pressure on us from that standpoint. So to this point, I think just trying to balance it all has been very important. I think this year, 2016, you can see we've published guidance for the first time here, and yeah, we'll break even, despite investing 80 to 85 million in our pipeline. But, you know, the reason we're going to break even is because we got a $35, $37 million one-time gain out of the land in Shanghai. So I think looking forward, I don't think we'll ever become a $100 million cash burn biotech that you know, puts the pressure on from that standpoint. But at the same time, we are not slowing down. You know, these seven pivotal studies are going at full speed. You know, we're taking more aggressive stance as we have with the AstraZeneca deal, and putting $50 million in over the next 3 years. So we're not sort of holding back because we want to break even over the next few years. But we'll be careful, we'll be sensible, and, you know, we're not going to completely change our mindset. It's all about balance for us and ensuring that we have multiple shots on goal, that we're not a binary biotech, and that our China business just continues to grow and underpin a big portion of the market capitalization of the company, and, you know, it's our safety blanket, as it were. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I understand. $100 million is not a lot to lose in my world. But
I know.
So I have a few sort of quick data-driven questions. So fruquintinib in all-comers gastric cancer, you had kind of an exciting titration trial going on. Did you get all the way to full-dose taxanes? And can you talk about where that program sits relative to colorectal and lung and sort of your how enthusiastic you are?
Yeah, we remain enthusiastic. But so we have the combination of fruquintinib and paclitaxel. We've basically got 80 milligram paclitaxel combined with 4 milligrams fruquintinib. Now, 4 milligram fruquintinib is going to get you 24-hour a day 100% VEGFR inhibition. So we're there. We've got that dose finding study complete. What we're doing right now is we are expanding the phase 1B study, just getting more and more patient data. You know, we've seen the same kind of things that ramucirumab saw in those gastric cancer patients in combination with paclitaxel. You've got neutropenia that's manageable. But, you know, we're just getting more and more data. So we'll decide what to do in that area. Gastric in China is quite a complex area. There's a VEGFR inhibitor, a multi-kinase VEGFR inhibitor that's approved in the third line setting. That makes things complicated in the second line setting. Because you're basically seeing off-label usage in all kinds of areas. So we've just got to be very careful. I think in a fair, clean, apples-to-apples comparison, fruquintinib and paclitaxel in the second-line setting, I think would do very well. But at the same time, complex environment, and we want to get a bit more data in the 1B before we decide what to do on that.
Okay, fair enough. And then for apitinib, what does success look like? Is there a good data set? I mean, a lot of these, you know, you do see responses for the current drugs, mostly because, you know, the blood-brain barrier is all chewed up. So do you have a sense of what success would look like in your phase 1B trial in terms of response rate?
I'll let Weigl answer that one. Go ahead, Weigl. I'll put you on the spot.
Well, Tom, we plan to present the phase 1B data at the World Lung Conference later this year. So we have an abstract. So we submitted an abstract. But today we still have a relatively small sample size of around 15, 20 patients. So what you're seeing is basically we're seeing responses both in the lung as well as in the brain, as we have showed a few charts here in this presentation. So in terms of response rate, kind of like you would expect for an EGFR inhibitor in the EGFR mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer patients.
Yeah, so basically you're seeing in the brain what you're seeing in the lung, which you don't tend to see with Iressa and Tarceva. You do see responses if the blood-brain barrier is compromised, as you've said. But what we're seeing with apitinib is, you know, in naive, untreated EGFR mutant positive non-small cell lung cancer patients with brain mets, you're seeing just great efficacy in the lung and the brain, pretty much across the board. But the reason we're being a bit cagey on this and not putting a percentage out there is because we're still waiting. We're getting a few more patient data. We're in dialogue with the CFDA on this one. The design of our pivotal study will be driven by what the ultimate response rate is in this 1B. Because, you know, if you've got a very high response rate, you could probably do almost an open label phase two pivotal study. If you've got a response rate in the sort of what you'd expect in the lung for an EGFR inhibitor level, then maybe the design of the pivotal study is slightly different. I think the next couple of months this all plays out, and I expect us to determine our pivotal study design before the end of the year and just kick it off, basically.
All right, perfect. And then last question. For sulfatinib in neuroendocrine tumors, you're enrolling phase threes. Are you very early? Are you anywhere near sort of your steady state spend on those trials, or should we think of that as just getting started?
Well, we've got about 20 centers already opened on those two neuroendocrine tumor studies. At the moment, I think we're going to go up to maybe another 10 more centers each, about 30 centers. So they're well started. I'd say enrollment is starting to get going. But you know, often in these phase three studies, the early stages are relatively slow. But then when physicians at all of these far-flung clinical centers, they start to see efficacy, and then the enrollment really picks up. That's what happened in the colorectal cancer phase three with fruquintinib, and we expect it will now start kicking in the lung cancer on fruquintinib as well. So NET is on track. It's doing well. You know, these phase threes in China are not massively expensive. You know, we're talking sort of 10 to 15 million U.S. for one of these studies. So getting those sites up and running, yes, that costs you. So if you've got a $10-15 million study, maybe the first 6 months is going to cost you $6 or $7 to get started, and then you get into your flow, and the balance second half of the spend plays out over sort of 12 to 18 months. You know, so we're through the first half of our spend on those NET studies, basically.
All right, perfect. All right, thanks a lot for all the answers. Good luck with. Sounds like you'll be busy.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom.
We don't have any more questions coming through, so just a quick reminder that if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. We don't have any further questions. I'll hand back to you, Christian.
Okay. No, just say thank you, everybody, for joining. And if you need anything from us, just reach out. And look forward to seeing how everything plays out over the next 6 to 9 months. Thanks very much for joining.
Thank you for joining today's conference. You may now replace your handsets.